By contrast to power built on workplace organization, welfare state programs seem to make people dependent, they co-opt people, they even fragment workplace identities and distract people from the main agenda of political reform, which presumably should be the reorganization of the economy. I think this sort of analysis and prognosis about what the welfare state means for power is very gloomy, and especially gloomy for women and for minorities. And the reason it's so gloomy is that while women are moving into the workplace, they're not moving into those parts, the kinds of workplaces, into those parts of the labor market where they are likely to follow the path of industrial workers and exercise strike power and union power. To the contrary, they're moving into those parts of the labor market which have historically been the most difficult to organize and are almost surely more difficult to organize now in the face of capital flight. If women are going to exercise power, it is very likely the case that they have to find ways of finding power within the context of their involvement with the welfare state. Which leads me to say that the critique which argues that welfare state programs rob people, and women especially, of power is much too simple. It's true that the programs fragment. It's true that they co-opt. At the same time, I think it's also the case that the availability of benefits for older women has given these women some security and therefore some power in family relations, and especially in relation to the adult children on whom they would otherwise have been completely dependent and who they would otherwise have been completely subject to. In a similar way, I think the availability of programs like unemployment insurance or AFDC and food stamps and Medicaid for younger women raising their children has also been a source of some security and therefore some defense against male breadwinners to whom they would otherwise be entirely exposed. And I think also that the availability of these programs, and now I include programs like unemployment insurance, has been a source of security and therefore of power to women in the workplace. Remember, these women are working in jobs where they are not unionized, where employers hold the constant threat, terror really, of being fired over the heads of women in fast foods, in hospitals, in office cleaning jobs. And for these women too, the knowledge that they can turn to AFDC, food stamps or Medicaid, that they and their children will not be homeless, has been some source of power in the workplace. More important, I think that, or maybe not more important, but just as important, I think the institutions of the welfare state have generated possibilities for political mobilization that have heretofore been virtually entirely ignored. Political mobilizations now vis-a-vis the state, the mobilization of women against the state, on which they are presumably made dependent by welfare state programs. I think we've ignored this possibility despite the instances, the experiences we've had, for example, of a movement like Welfare Rights, where the recipients of AFDC did organize and did have some impact. We haven't paid too much attention to the success of older women in resisting the attempted cuts in the Social Security program, the Medicare program, in the last few years. We haven't had much to say in a theoretical spirit about the successes of social welfare organizations. These are organizations created by the welfare state, organizations of employees and organizations of agencies who have mobilized both on the national level and on the state level to resist the budget cuts, and with a fair amount of success. They didn't reverse them, but they did stop them in the course of the second year, with the result that the deficit grew. Now, given the kinds of powerful business interests that are clamoring to reduce the deficit, the ability of these groups to stop social welfare cuts and maintain the deficits is something to wonder about. I think there is another important possibility for the mobilization of resistance of women through the welfare state. It was signaled some 10 days ago by the Democratic primary in New York State. Some 350,000 more people voted than had voted in the 1980 primary. And when the count was in, it turned out that women were 58% of the voters in the New York State primary. That event confirmed a pattern that has been developing over the last couple of years. In 1982, there was a rise of 10 million people in electoral participation, 10 million more than the previous midterm election. And that rise was the result of increased voting among the unemployed, among minorities, and among women. That may be very significant. Its significance is suggested by the election of 1980, in which only half the American electorate voted, a repetition of a long-standing pattern in American electoral politics, in which about half votes in the 20th century in presidential elections, and that half is the better half, better off half of the American electorate. Well, political scientists have puzzled a lot about why that is so, because the United States has the lowest turnout of any major democracy. If I had more than 15 minutes, I could, in a very sober and judicious way, review the theories that they have produced. But then I would come to the conclusion, which I'll now give you without the review, that low turnout in the United States in the 20th century, and especially low turnout among those who are worse off, is directly traceable to the extraordinary electoral procedures we have in the United States, which make it difficult for people to vote, and especially personal voter registration. That system of obstructions was put in place around the turn of the century by planter interests who mobilized in the South and industrial interests who mobilized in the North to change state election laws so as to disenfranchise some groups outright with poll taxes and literacy tests and so forth, and to make the remainder of working and poor people make it much more difficult for them to vote through the elaborate rigmarole of personal voter registration, which made it impossible for people to register to vote when an election approached, closed 6 months before an election, which eliminated voter registration places in working class towns, in mining towns, which made voter registration available only during working hours and only for a couple of days a year, and so on. That system was put in place in the first place by a class mobilization, industrialists and planters. But it has been kept in place throughout the 20th century by the interests of political incumbents who do not want a new electorate and who will mobilize themselves whenever any proposal for election reform is made. Well, I said a moment ago that there were signs of a surge. More people are turning out. And that's true. But the procedural obstructions that account for low turnout in the United States are still in place. And therefore, for this surge to be realized, for the polarization of the electorate which is now taking place, an electorate that's been activated by current policies of the Reagan administration, for it really to be fully expressed and fully realized in a surge to the polls, people have to be helped to overcome the obstacles to voter registration. And one way to do that is to take advantage of the vast apparatus of social welfare agencies that have come into existence in the United States. Those agencies reach into every community in the country. They reach into poor neighborhoods and into working class neighborhoods. The people who staff those agencies are mainly women and minorities. And the people who depend upon those agencies, who come to these agencies continually in continual streams for benefits and for services, are mainly women and minorities. I'm working on a voter registration campaign. Tema mentioned it. It's called Human Serve. It's a campaign that's been endorsed by 20 national social welfare organizations calling for in-agency registration. And it's a campaign that now has organizers in 13 states in the United States. The campaign is beginning to spread. And across the country, welfare offices, Planned Parenthood offices, other family planning agencies, daycare agencies, health clinics, well baby clinics, the workers in these systems are beginning to offer help with voter registration to the women who come to them for services and for benefits. The potential of this kind of development is enormous, because no one is going to create an enormous voter registration campaign oriented toward the poor and especially toward poor women. No one is going to give $10 million for such an effort, but this is a way to take advantage of a set of institutional arrangements that are already in place. And in complicated ways, I know that it's complicated and ambivalent, have brought better off and better educated women who work in the agencies into a regular relationship with tens of millions of women who depend upon the agencies. I feel a certain urgency about this development, about voter registration. I suppose part of the reason for the urgency is evident. In 1984, we're going to elect a president, and there is no way, I think, to overstate the significance of the American presidency. The next president is going to decide whether to intervene or not intervene in regional conflicts across the globe. The next president, by his legislative and administrative initiatives, is going to decide on the outlines of our social policies, our environmental policies, and also on the main outlines of our private economy, what we call our private economy, as it's reorganized to take account of international competition and rapidly increasing technological change. The next president is going to decide whether to push the button or not to push the button. And the next president is also going to create the kind of cultural, the kind of political environment which makes possible the encouragement of the hopes, the aspirations, and the political movements by women, by minorities, by poor people in the United States, or he will create a political environment which crushes those hopes and those aspirations. For all those reasons, I feel a certain urgency about what happens in 1984, but I also think it matters who is in the American electorate in the longer run. I don't think it is a complete solution to the political problems of the United States to finally begin to include poor working people, women, minorities in the American electoral universe. But I do think it is one step we can take that would make a difference. Thank you.
Okay, fine. I'm sorry. It's for anybody. Oh. Anybody who spent very much time around this community, Columbia University, in the past year has found it hard to miss Barbara Ransby. As co-chairperson for the Free South Africa Committee, she's done I won't say more than anybody, but she's certainly been up there in awakening people's consciousness to the relationship between the ownership of stock in this university and the labor conditions and social conditions in South Africa. It's my pleasure to introduce Barbara Ransby.
Okay. I'm going to follow Grace Paley's lead and remain seated. The load I'm carrying with me these days has gotten heavier as the days progressed, so I feel a little more comfortable staying seated. I want to speak briefly about the need to incorporate anti-racist politics into the formulation of a progressive feminist agenda. This seems to me quite consistent with the theme of this conference, especially since women of color have historically been in the lead of struggles for social change in this country and indeed around the world. I also want to draw some parallels with the situation in South Africa, the struggle for freedom in that country, because I think we can learn a lot, and that situation can help us to clarify the need and importance for such a synthesis. Over the past few years, as Tim mentioned, I've been involved in an anti-racist struggle on this campus and the campus across the street. The particular demand of that struggle has been to get this university, to get Columbia University, that is, to divest its holdings in those companies that do business in Southern Africa. Those investments amount to over $44 million at this point. In any event, this political involvement, as well as the meetings and discussions I've had with a number of black and progressive white South Africans, have led me to attempt to make some comparisons between the situation in South Africa and the struggle against racism and sexism in this country. With all due respect to the uniqueness of the South African situation, I do think that there are some comparisons that can be made and some lessons learned from the two situations. In a very general sense, both countries are multiracial societies where historically racism has been used to guarantee the super exploitation of the non-white population. In this country, there is still de facto segregation. There is still de facto disfranchisement of a large section of the non-white population. And the economic oppression of people of color in this country seems to increase day by day, especially under the policies of the current administration. All of these aspects of racism certainly exist in South Africa. They exist to a much greater degree, and they are more visible and blatant in their appearance, and the enforcement is much more brutal. Consequently, the overt and undeniable expressions of racism which exist in South Africa lead very few progressive people to conclude that the struggle against racism and sexism can be divorced. I think most progressive-minded people in that country recognize that the two struggles are inseparable and have to be. In this country, the more subtle nature of racism doesn't always make the necessity for such a synthesis very clear. So I think we need to constantly remind ourselves of the importance of incorporating anti-racist politics into a progressive feminist agenda. A quick look at the racial realities and the dynamics of resistance in South Africa, I think, make it even clearer. In South Africa, 23 million non-white people suffer under one of the most brutal and racist regimes on the face of the earth. For those of you who may not be familiar with some of the details of the apartheid system, it's a system where 72% of the population, which happen to be non-white, are denied some of the most basic political and human rights. It is a system where black workers earn only a fraction of the wages of their white counterparts by law. It's a system where over 50% of black children fail to reach the age of 5 because they die of malnutrition or lack of health care. It's a country where a set of racist past laws are vigilantly enforced. These laws make black and other non-white people in that country essentially prisoners in their own homeland. They're required to carry passbooks 24 hours to prove that they are legitimately in white areas. That's the reality for the people who live in South Africa. Now, women of color in South Africa suffer doubly from the kind of oppressive regime that is in power there. They suffer both because they are people of color and because they are women. Because racism has perverted and permeated every aspect of life in that country, women of color can never separate racial oppression and class oppression from the gender-based oppression they feel as women. Consequently, any progressive feminist movement which emerges in that country must at the same time be a consciously anti-racist movement. Otherwise, it threatens to become an unconsciously racist one. In fact, racism and separatist ideology is a constant threat to the strength and unity of all progressive movements in that country. The history of South African women's resistance to both racism and sexism within the context of a single struggle also makes it clear why any progressive feminist movement must also be an anti-racist one. This morning I participated in the workshop on women's resistance in South Africa, and I think there was a good example in that workshop of why this particular point is true. We saw a film called You've Struck a Rock that some of you may have heard of. And the title is quite appropriate because in the 1950s, when black women of South Africa rose up to oppose the racist past laws in that country, the almighty South African government had indeed struck a rock. And the heroic leadership of these women continues to be an inspiration to the liberation struggle there and to those of us in this country who are involved in the anti-racist movement. In that struggle, women marched and demonstrated and rallied and confronted the armed South African police. Hundreds of them were jailed and dozens were killed in that struggle. Now, of course, the struggle against the past laws was not only a struggle of women, but was a struggle in which women gave leadership to men. The past laws not only affect non-white women in South Africa, but affect non-white men as well. Nevertheless, because the aspect of their oppression which these women chose to focus on was not strictly gender-based, does not mean that it is any less legitimate or that it is irrelevant to a progressive feminist movement. These kind of struggles are crucially relevant. That becomes quite evident in a situation such as South Africa. It has to be more evident to us in this country. In the case of black women's resistance to the past laws, while on the surface the struggle may not appear to have been an explicitly anti-sexist one, it was indeed that as well as an anti-racist struggle. These women had to overcome a number of obstacles in order to engage in the kind of courageous struggle and campaign that they engaged in. The first obstacle was their own sexist training and fear of engaging in political activity, especially confrontational activity. The second was probably the struggle with their men to accept their leadership and to accept their militancy. Thirdly, and perhaps with most difficulty, they had to find the courage and strength within themselves to challenge one of the most militaristic and repressive governments there is, the South African government. Now, the challenge of these women to the fascist white male-dominated power structure of South Africa was a blow not only for those women, but for all oppressed women. It was a blow for all oppressed people. And again, it's the kind of struggle which has to be relevant to any progressive feminist movement. It is undeniably relevant, I think, to all of us. In this country, as well as in South Africa, the inclusion of anti-racist politics in the women's movement is equally as crucial. It's particularly crucial at this point in time when a number of people live under the illusion that racism in this country is either dead or dying. Unfortunately, this couldn't be further from the truth. And if we need proof of it, I think we can venture beyond the iron gates out front and down the hill a bit, and there are a number of aspects of life in the community that surrounds this one that will show us that racism is unfortunately alive and well. It exists in Harlem, it exists in Bed-Stuy, it exists in Detroit and Chicago and Watts and 100 other places we could name. Racism is not only still alive, but it is in fact on the rise right now. And as was pointed out before, I think a number of the attacks in social services, particularly healthcare, demonstrate this. These cutbacks have been felt the sharpest by working class women of color. Women in minimum wage jobs, women on welfare, women with men with no jobs, and children to feed. Just as in South Africa, I think most working class women of color in this country find it very difficult to separate their racial and class oppression from the gender-based oppression they feel as women. Any progressive feminist movement in this country, I think, has to take that into account. In this regard, I think that it's quite appropriate that the underlying theme of this conference, in addition to its focus on resistance, has attempted to give particular emphasis to the struggles of women of color and ethnic women. Despite the weaknesses that Barbara Smith pointed out, which are certainly more than evident to all of us, that the disgracefully low number of minority women that are here today, I nonetheless think that the topic organization represents some step in the right direction. Unfortunately, other conferences like this that I've attended, the women of color tend to gravitate toward one workshop which has a topic related to racism, and again we preach to the converted and talk among ourselves about the need for fighting racism. It's clearly a much healthier and necessary dynamic, I think, for all of us to come together and discuss the implications of fighting racism as it affects all of us. This approach reflects the view that racism is not simply a black issue or a Latin issue, but it's an issue which all progressive people have a stake in. In fact, historically, racism has been used to divide and weaken virtually every progressive movement which has emerged in this country, from the labor movement to the early women's suffrage movement, the anti-war movement of the 60s. None of these have been exempt. But we can learn some things from not only the situation in South Africa, but from this history, and guarantee that it doesn't repeat itself yet another time. I think there are some specific ways that we can learn from this history and move toward developing an anti-racist and progressive feminist agenda. First, I think it's necessary to link up with anti-racist struggles, even though the particular demands of those struggles are not always gender-based. Second, I think the fight against internal racism has to be stepped up within the women's movement by integrating discussions of racism into broader feminist dialogues. Thirdly, I think we have to acknowledge that we live in a class society where the overwhelming majority of women of color are part of the working class and are the most oppressed section of the society. And this recognition has to lead us to support the political and economic struggles of these women in a more concrete way. In conclusion, I'd just like to reemphasize that we look at the situation in South Africa, the attempt to define a progressive feminist perspective in that country, and look at other historical examples, and move in the direction of incorporating anti-racist ideas into a progressive feminist agenda for the 80s and the 90s. Thank you.
One of the sad truths about the left, and I think the feminist movement in this country, is that we are often more noticed by our adversaries than we recognize our own strength. We read the and listened to the Nixon Watergate tapes. We understood how scared they actually were by the massive demonstrations in the streets and by the opposition in the streets and throughout society to the Vietnam War. I think when we learn the history of the Reagan administration and what almost happened in the fall and what may still happen again, but what seemed very likely in October and November and December about an invasion or a bombing of Nicaragua, we may learn that in fact our mobilizations are more than half-hearted efforts to get out people and raise consciousness about what was going on may have won us and the Nicaraguan people the first round. At the center of those struggles were many organizations, not the least of them was USACA, U.S. out of Central America, and one of the most articulate spokespeople for that group is our last speaker, Elizabeth Martinez. Thank you.
Let me just begin by saying that I am glad to be the last speaker, in fact, because there's some very practical suggestions and ideas that I want to leave people with here today. In addressing the topic of women and resistance, I think we come to the question, inevitably, of resistance against what? And the related question, why should women in particular resist? I would like to speak to these questions today and to take the example of Nicaraguan women as they lived before the overthrow of Somoza, as their lives have changed in Sandinista society, and as they now resist the attempt by our own government to destroy that new society. Before the Sandinista victory of 1979, Nicaraguan women stood alongside the women of all Central American countries as part of what we need to see as a great global pool of cheap labor. That labor is super exploited for the benefit of a world economy. It's a world economy that is capitalist, and it's a world economy over which the United States had very clear domination until very recently. That women in Nicaragua, as in these other countries, have been super exploited in two areas, through unpaid labor in the home, and through underpaid labor as workers, whether they were in fact employed or not. This super exploitation, which in fact supports this entire economic system of the world, is sustained in turn by male supremacist definitions of women and their labor. And I think the key to these definitions is the concept of domestic labor as a private service to the husband, to another individual or a small family unit, rather than seeing it as part of the family's whole social function. It is social, it is not private, but it has been mystified so that we see as a private function this entire reproduction of labor power, generation of new workers within this capitalist world system. That mystification then has made it possible to devalue and undervalue women's labor. There are many lessons for us, I think, for all women in the analysis along these lines of Marlene Dixon about the interrelationship between sexism and capitalism. Her work laid the analytical basis for a major insight of the women's movement, and that is that the status of women is not a national issue, it is an international issue. And that sexism, like racism, is endemic to this capitalist system and to imperialism. What I'm saying then really is, I'm speaking then about the centrality of women in a great global struggle. We're not just a little bit more exploited. There's a fundamental significance about the role of women within that world economy that makes then what women do and their resistance central to a whole worldwide process. Now, for women in the third world, there's the additional element of imperialist domination. Under the heel, a heavy heel, of the U.S. empire, women of color have experienced the most acute forms of super-exploitation. The problem with imperialism, however, is that it engenders very ferocious resistance, because it clearly oppresses not just a sector or a segment of a population, but the entire people. I think when we look at the women of Nicaragua, we see these realities I've been describing very clearly illustrated. For decades, they endured super exploitation as part of that worldwide working class of the countries that we call peripheral or semi-peripheral, third world underdeveloped countries in relationship to this capitalist developed countries. They were, if you like, the chiquita bananas of the banana republic from the viewpoint of the corporations which have now become transnational in their exploitation of this kind of labor. Now, their labor enabled the making of vast, really monstrously inflated profits. Nicaraguan women also experienced the effects of all the ideological forces and institutions that uphold male supremacy. The Latino version, of course, is called machismo. It is the same idea of seeing women's labor as a private service to a man, as that's the foundation then for devaluation. There's a single statistic that I ran across very recently, which I think conveys very clearly what it meant to be a woman in Nicaragua under U.S. imperialist domination. Before the overthrow of Somoza, the general illiteracy rate in Nicaragua was 42%, but the illiteracy rate for women was 93%. In other words, if Nicaragua's general population was exploited by U.S. interests, it was women who provided the bulwark for the entire edifice of imperialist domination to an astounding and enraging degree. But Nicaraguan women also have a tradition of resistance, which dates back to the refusal of indigenous women to bear children because their children would be born into slavery. And from the early days of the Sandinista movement, women participated in all forms of struggle. They fought, they nursed, they carried messages clandestinely. Of course, they cooked and cleaned, and they died. They also organized themselves. The first organization that took real roots was based, as in other Latin American countries, and we heard about that in the panel this morning, on women's protest against the disappeared, husbands, sons, brothers. This was AMPRONAC. It carried out massive protests. It was a very broad-based, cross-class movement. And originally, there were many upper-class women in AMPRONAC. As the struggle against Somoza intensified, the class lines tended to sharpen. Many of those women left. And this was inevitable, I think, because it became clearer every day that the specific grievances of women required change in the entire existing system. The repression that the women encountered from AMPRONAC made this clear, to the point where it came down to many women understanding the stakes and indeed losing their fear of death. Or, on the other hand, retreating to class privilege and identification with the system. By the time of the Sandinista triumph, AMPRONAC was a mass movement with thousands of women, and it laid the basis for the organization of women in the new society. The changes in the lives of Nicaraguan women, which have taken place since 1979, have been massive and fundamental. There's no way I can describe them all here today, but let me just point to a few. There are, first of all, the profound changes which all Nicaraguans want is a result of the ending of the kind of exploitation experienced under imperialism and the bloody tyranny of Somoza. These brought benefits to women also. The near ending of illiteracy and the total disappearance of once common diseases are just examples of that. For women in particular, There are new laws passed since 1979, which I think are very interesting because they give such a clear picture of what it was like in the past, as well as, of course, holding out the promise of change for the future. There is a law that says men cannot be paid for work women do in cotton and coffee cultivation. In other words, in the past, the women did the work, the men got the pay. This was a common practice. There are laws extending Social Security benefits to women and establishing equal pay, neither of which existed before. There are laws concerning adoption, alimony, and family relations that really challenge patriarchal authority and are the subject of massive debate all over Nicaragua. There is a law outlawing the use of women as sex symbols in advertising. The thing that's very striking when you visit there is the massive participation of women in and in leading roles throughout the society. Just a few quick statistics. Women are 55% of the adult education workers, who are called brigadistas, 88% of the vaccination workers. They form 60 to 70% of the all Nicaraguans who do guard duty in the neighborhoods and marketplaces as a protection against the Contras. They form 48% of the militia. The National Women's Organization today is called AMLAI, named after Luisa Amanda Espinosa, the first woman to die in combat against Somoza. Interesting also the fact that AMLAI holds an official seat in the Council of State. In other words, the interests of women as women are recognized officially and represented officially, a step which not even most socialist countries have taken. All this integration has come about largely through the participation of women in the mass organizations, which is the key to the kind of emancipation that has happened. And the result, and I think you feel this there, is nothing less than a level of dignity and well-being and a recognition of women's humanity that never existed under U.S. imperialism. Now, what is happening today? What is happening today, very clearly, is a massive effort spearheaded by Reagan to turn the clock back. By supporting the Contras, what can he mean except restoring the society from which women have, in great degrees, and it's an ongoing struggle, but have been liberated from in Nicaragua? It is bringing back all the oppression, all the exploitation before. And therefore, it is women who have the most to lose in Nicaragua, as one example, from the policies of the United States, from the entire counter-revolution. I think we need to see Reagan's support for the Contras as part of a foreign policy that can only be called fascist by virtue of its support for dictatorial regimes or the ending of liberated society. That foreign policy is mirrored domestically in policies that stands on women in the United States, for example, on the right to choose, which also represent a return to the past, a neo-fascist spirit. So here we have a fascist kind of foreign policy and domestically the mirror of that that we all know so well. Then I think we can begin to understand how the mining of Nicaraguan harbors is nothing less than part of a whole effort to turn out one of the few lights in this hemisphere, a light that's right here, very close to us and to our own lives. We need to understand U.S. policy today as a product of that empire that I spoke about earlier that had such an effect on women's lives in Nicaragua, among other countries, of an empire in decline at a time of crisis in that entire capitalist world economy. Since Vietnam, the United States has been steadily losing its political influence and economic power around the world. Yet the government retains its belief that it can act as the world's policeman. Is unable to impose its political or diplomatic will on other nations, so it turns increasingly to military adventurism. Reagan is acting out what has been described by Marlene Dixon as the Suez Syndrome. which is the last-ditch effort of a declining power to preserve its shrinking influence when it can no longer impose its will on its allies or the world. And she compares the United States today to Great Britain in 1956, when it foolishly and hopelessly, and in total isolation almost, attempted to prevent the nationalization by Egypt of the Suez Canal. That was the last gasp of a dying, isolated empire refusing to recognize the reality of worldwide change. But the Suez Syndrome is not simply a threat to Nicaragua today. What we see is an interventionist foreign policy combined with the belief that nuclear war is winnable. The highest civilian and military leadership in the United States actually think that the United States can win a nuclear war with the Soviet Union and that we must prepare to win it. I think the damaging of the Soviet tanker off the coast of Nicaragua by mines that the CIA placed is a classic scenario for the escalation of a local U.S. military intervention into a worldwide nuclear disaster. It becomes all the more likely when we realize that the United States cannot, in fact, win in Central America. It cannot turn back the tide of people's struggle and revolutionary movement. It cannot stop it unless it's by bombing back to the Stone Age, of Reagan's phrase. That is the only way. It cannot stop it otherwise. But that is precisely, again, why the danger seems so great today. Now, the weak point of the escalating militarism lies in the opposition of the American people, and this is where we must look for hope. To whatever degree the brakes have been put on Reagan's policies, it's thanks to public protest. USACA, U.S. Out of Central America, the organization with which I work, has been part of the effort to mount that protest. And we see as particularly important linking together the anti-interventionist forces in this country and the anti-nuclear, anti-war peace movements for precisely the reasons I have described in talking about the great danger today. USACA is a national organization, to tell you just a little bit about it, committed to the building of a massive movement against U.S. intervention and militarism. It carries out a wide range of activities that include educational work, demonstrations, lobbying, teach-ins, delegations to Nicaragua, and so forth. We have a table here today where you can get literature about our work, and I'd like to introduce Janice Lewin over there. You should stand up, Janice. She's got her hand up, who is an organizer and would be very glad to talk to you. Let me tell you now about three immediate campaigns or areas of work in which I would very much like to urge you to participate. First of all, there is a new campaign to support Nicaragua's appeal to the World Court against Reagan's act of war in mining the harbors. As you know, the administration has said it will not recognize the World Court's authority. I think never has it been so clear that Reagan is really an international bandit and absolutely has declared himself outside world law. This is intolerable, and this is something we must and can do something about. So we are, USACA is preparing to petition Congress to have the United States recognize the court's authority and at the same time bring pressure on the court to accept the case. We're also thinking of sending a delegation to The Hague to back this up. So I'd just like to say to you, to urge you to send cables to the court, send cables to Congress, pushing for recognition of the court's authority and for the court to take the case. I think this is a crucial moment with mounting opposition when we have here a chance to make this a world issue to bring tremendous pressure. And for those of you who are really interested in this first campaign I'm going to speak of, there's even a meeting Wednesday night. We have very practical here. There's a meeting at the USACA office in New York City next Wednesday at 7 p.m. to work on this whole World Court campaign. And that's at 208 West 13th Street. We think it's really crucial to go with this opposition now and to take advantage of the very historical fact of this case coming before the World Court. This is something new. The American people have not, in general, been involved in this kind of thing. It's time to do so. Secondly, there's a lobbying campaign going on to oppose more military aid to the murderous regime of El Salvador and the Contras. And I just want to urge people to lobby, personally lobby, your congressman over the Easter recess, which is from next Monday until the 24th. You can get them at home. And in particular, to lobby members of the House Conference Committee, which will be considering the aid to El Salvador and the Contras. There are two New York State members of this committee, the Conference Committee, and they are Jack Kemp and Joseph Addabbo. Take it or leave it. But anyway, they are on a committee. We need to keep up that pressure. And clearly, Reagan is all out to move ahead willy-nilly, but nevertheless, the issue is still in the House, and we can do something about it. And finally, I would like to invite all of you to an international conference on revolution and intervention in Central America, which USACA is co-sponsoring with other groups at the New School for Social Research on May 5th. And this is another attempt to influence debate at a very critical moment. I think, you know, I've been talking about stopping horrors and stopping very dreadful things from happening. There is another way, though, I'd like to speak of it, which is that if we can stop this juggernaut of Reagan's militarism, it is not only the people of Central America, and particularly the women, who will benefit. Here in the United States, very immediately, the burden of a monstrous military budget, which has led to incredible cuts in services that we heard about earlier, would be lifted. And in the longer run, we see in the revolutionary movements of Central America the hope for basic social change in our own country. If the grip of empire loosens to the south, as it clearly has begun to do, the door opens for the working people of our own land. Thus, we live in an hour of great danger, but also great hope. An hour of tremendous importance for women who have so long upheld this oppressive world economy. The women of Nicaragua, about whom I have spoken, are standing ready and have been to defending their country with their own lives. I think that women here in the United, for us women here in the United States, we must heed our own call to combat. Thank you.
Before we begin what will be a very abbreviated question and answer and discussion section, I think 20 minutes is the most we can take, I'd like to introduce Jane Gould, my predecessor and the founder of the Barnard Women's Center and the founder of the Scholar and Feminist Conference, and most of what's good that comes out of these conferences is due to the tradition she established. So, stand up. We have two microphones here. You need not limit yourself to questions, but I would also like to hear from people in the individual forums about what they think transpired or what are the major issues, so on. You'll have to form lines in front of the two floor mics, and I'm really going to cut off discussion at 10 after 5 so that we can proceed to the final portion, which is very much in keeping with the whole tradition of this conference. Let me also warn you, you're welcome to give your names, but all of this is being recorded by WBAI and will be played on Mother's Day. And if you feel uncomfortable about being recorded, perhaps you should speak at the reception or keep your name hidden or whatever you want to do to protect yourself. But we can't get waivers from everybody, so you are being recorded.
I've had a very good time at this conference, and I can't...
Is that mic on?
Hold on. Hello? Can you hear me?
Wait.
Okay.
Now, maybe you should turn it around and face the... You're on.
Hello? Yeah. Okay. This has been a very good conference, and I've enjoyed every one I've heard, and I can't think of anyone that I would like to have cut. But on the other hand, every one of these conferences I've ever been to before had a balance between scholarship and activists. And this conference, I've heard nothing but activists. I haven't heard any scholarship. And I'm confused about that. I mean, my work is in theory, and I come to this conference these conferences regularly because I like the interaction, I like the balance, and I like a positive visioning of myself as a theoretician at the front of the room. And I didn't have it this time, and it upset me.
Pull it down.
I ask this question not only as a Jewish woman, but also as a lesbian, and I address it to Barbara Smith. What do you mean by saying that you have no problems with men when it is white men who create, own, and run this, quote, imperialist war machine, unquote, not women, white, or of color? I know that white women are oppressors, too. However, if you have problems with the imperialist war machine, you must have problems at least with white men, if not with men of color.
Can everybody, was everyone able to hear her?
Yes.
Okay.
We couldn't follow that?
Yes.
The question was, what I said that I didn't have problems with men. I'm so glad you asked it because the part of the sentence that I didn't quite include was that what I have problems with is patriarchy, capitalism, racism, and sexual oppression, which means that I have problems with the systematic exploitation and oppression of people, not necessarily with the individuals, who are the representatives or the people who are carrying it out. I was also trying to speak about my position as a woman of color and a lesbian of color who is in solidarity with not just the men of my race, but with all third world people. Men, women, and children for our liberation globally. So that's why I say I don't have problems with men, because if I only define my politics in opposition to men, that means that I erase, half of the population of people of color in the world.
I'm going to make a brief statement describing the work of our workshop, which was on immigrants and refugees. Okay. I'm making a brief statement for our workshop, which was on immigrants and refugees. We heard from Silvia Sandoval, who represents the Asociación de Mujeres del Salvador, and who described some of the work that Salvadoran women are doing here in New York, in other cities of the United States, as well as in Salvador and in countries like Nicaragua. They're very active raising funds, organizing women into productive associations, doing childcare, or setting up childcare centers, etc. She is standing at the end here. There is a table if you want more information. We also heard from Adassa Santini, who is a labor lawyer, who works with the Center for Labor Relations at Rutgers University. One of the things she talked about was migrant farm workers. Usually when we think about migrant farm workers, we think about the bottom of the occupational scale. She pointed out that within that stratum, you can bring in the gender variable, and it turns out that women are even worse off than the men. We also heard from Anna Dumois, who represented the Family Planning Council. She gave a minority perspective on the issue of family planning, and described it as an issue of empowerment. It's not just a question of population control, nor is it a question simply of having as many babies as you want. It is a question of creating conditions within which the babies that you do want to have can raise to be fully enfranchised human beings. So sort of a reconceptualizing of the issue of family planning in terms of empowerment of people. So that one of the things, for example, the organization is doing is voter registration among women. It is a very broad approach. Finally, I would like to thank Tema Kaplan for what was a wonderful conference. I agree with Constance that scholarship was not rampant, but at the same time, a lot of us come from the world of scholarship, and it is wonderful to hear a lot of the scholars on the panel talk about activist issues. Thank you very much.
I'm speaking for myself and a number of other people who met with me after the, in between the speeches. I'm concerned about one of the speeches made by Bernice Reagan. I know there's been a lot said about coalition and women of all different beliefs and groups getting together in orientations. We should have a coalition, and I agree with that. And that we should bear witness for each other, and I agree to that. But today I bore witness to something that infuriated me and made me very upset. I bore witness to a woman rationalizing an anti-Semitic remark by a man and women in the audience applauding it, and that hurt me very deeply. And that's one thing I will not bear witness to and will not be silent.
Yeah, one of the women earlier was talking about trying to raise the voter registration, and I think that if you take it from a practical point of view, I think a true democracy means that every single citizen of voting age votes. And I think that we can all agree that that's rather impractical, that the way things are now. So I would like to encourage people that if everyone would try just once not voting in the next presidential election, just see what happens.
Yeah, we already did that.
I think we tried that 4 years ago.
Right.
As a middle-aged white woman, I would like to state that I think racism is a white problem, basically, and I am ashamed that Ms. Pivon, who is an authority on discrimination, should use the word niggardly several times, especially without defining it.
I'm going to report back just briefly on the workshop forum that was held on feminism, anti-racism, and the peace movement. We managed to, in a short space of time, address the issues of the peace movement and of the anti-racist and justice and freedom movements from the position of peace camp activists. Scholars were in there all over the place, I'm sure. From the position of mothers, from the position of black women, we had women from the Medgar Evers College. And underneath everything that was being spoken about was a real understanding that we all live in a time of real confusion. And for myself, the confusion, which I would like to address to Grace, who I sort of adopt as some sort of mother. She doesn't know that, of course, but Sally talked about mothers, and Grace is one. Is how do we all who, I suppose we want peace eventually, and we don't want the world to blow up, and we don't want these animals to become eradicated or ourselves, but we don't want what's going on now to be going on like it's going on now every minute of every day at all times. And so for my own sake, I talk about peace, but I really want uproar, and I really want less quiet and less sitting back. And where does that put me?
Well, first of all, in a way, one doesn't like the word peace. You're right, Laura, having
a mother. I'm a bit lactic.
But no, I mean, I don't think that's the. I don't even. I would say anti-militarism. I wouldn't even say. I feel like you do, that we need a lot of noise, but I don't see the
the difference, you know, in any way. If you're active and if you just keep going and work every, you're going to be in trouble. Don't worry about it.
I have a question for Barbara Smith, only because I think she might give me the kind of answer I couldn't give.